Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut. As George Bush Sr. referred to Portland, Oregon when he was not received well in the way that he felt entitled to. Tom Hartman here with you. Wholesale sellout of core strategic assets to foreign acquirers. Say what? What is this stuff? Church's chicken, for example, has just become the first U.S. corporation to outsource all of its financial and accounting work to another company. Yep. Texas-based company, Church's Chicken, has hired WNS Global Services, which just happens to be based in India, to do all of their accounting. All of their accounting. Not just a little bit. All of it. Is America becoming vulnerable? Today, a front page story in today's Wall Street Journal about how Ben Bernanke is talking about inflation. Now, conventional wisdom yesterday was that Bernanke was going to have to lower interest rates because the U.S. economy was beginning to slide into recession. And what Greenspan did so effectively when Bush policies were driving us in, you know, cut taxes and increased spending, driving up the debt, bankrupting America. When Bush's policies began to throw us into a recession, what Greenspan did is he dropped interest rates so low that housing costs, you know, home mortgage rates went down, which drove up the value of homes, which drove up the perceived equity in homes. You know, everybody thought their house was worth a little more, so then they could easily borrow against it. And on TV, every other commercial was for a company that wanted to loan you money based on the value of your home. Have you seen any of those ads recently, by the way? I haven't seen an ad for Ditech in months. In any case, what happened was Americans turned their homes into piggy banks and took that money and spent it. And, you know, they're not just in improving their homes. They spent it on buying cars. They spent it on vacations. They spent it on going back to school. They spent it on just basically living from day to day. And we even hit a point where last year, for the first time since the Great Depression, we actually had a negative savings rate. People were spending more than they were earning. So the conventional wisdom in economic circles and business circles yesterday and in the weeks preceding yesterday was that in all probability, Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, was going to keep interest rates steady or drop them slightly in coming months in order to prevent the economy from sliding into a recession. Now Bernanke comes along and says, we're not sure that we've got inflation under control. Like I said, big front page story in today's Wall Street Journal. This is the financial story. This is the one that, you know, everybody in the business world is looking at going, whoa, what's this going to mean? Because if he has to raise interest rates, if he raises interest rates because he's perceiving inflation as being the problem du jour, if he's saying, okay, we've got a real problem with inflation, and the way that you slow down inflation is by slowing down the economy. You take some money out of circulation. How do you take money out of circulation? You raise interest rates. Fewer people can afford to borrow. Borrowing is what creates money out of thin air. The Federal Reserve Bank and their local banks, this is how they increase the money supply. This is how they create money, is by encouraging borrowing. If a bank has $10, that doesn't mean that they can loan $10. That means they can loan $100. Where did that $90 come from? They just created it out of thin air. So the more borrowing there is, the larger the money supply gets. You following this? So the idea was that And so if you want to contract an economy, if you think that the economy is, you know, there's too much money chasing too few goods, so you want to slightly contract the money supply and contract the economy, you raise interest rates. And that'll slow down the economy. Greenspan, in fact, was so upfront about this. He talked about how he would raise interest rates specifically, intentionally, exclusively to slow down an economy, to make it harder for people to find jobs. Because he felt that an important part of his job was to prevent what he called wage inflation. Wage inflation being what happens when people start saying, hey, you know, our union would like to bargain with your company for a wage increase. Now, for some reason, Greenspan never thought that wage inflation included CEOs making zillions. But, you know, when average workers made too much money, he thought that was a bad thing and didn't want anything to do with it. So now Bernanke is talking about inflation and about raising interest rates. But there are very few signs of inflation out there. Yes, I mean, oil prices have gone up, housing prices have gone up, but housing prices are dropping, energy prices have dropped recently. If anything, it looks like the economy is sliding backwards. So why would he talk about raising interest rates? Doesn't make any sense to anybody. Until you look at the fact that these insane economic policies of the last 26 years of having trade policies that basically sell out America, doing away with the traditional protections of American industries that we had from the founding of this country, literally from the founding of this country, until Ronald Reagan started dismantling them, and then George Herbert Walker Bush called for the total dismantling of them, what he referred to as the New World Order. And then Bill Clinton did dismantle most of them with GATT and NAFTA and the WTO. And then George Bush tried to speed it up even more, pushing through CAFTA and, you know, trying to get his Vietnam Free Trade Agreement and the Oman Free Trade, you know, all these other, you know, let's make it so it's free for multinational corporations to do business across international boundaries so that they can basically take more industry out of the United States and put it in cheap labor countries. So these insane economic policies, the combination of the insane trade policies with the insane borrow and spend policies. Keep in mind, you know, your share of the national debt right now, your share. If you're a single person and you're unattached to a family in any way, your share is $28,737.19. If you're the breadwinner of a family of four, your share is $114,948.77. So what these insane policies have brought us is an addiction not just to foreign oil, but also to foreign supplies of cash. We have had to borrow. We're right now, at this moment, in debt to the world, $8,629,995,297,533.22. And it's going up at the rate of about $70,000 a second. I'm watching the clock as it's ticking along. Now we're up to $571,592,614,635,000. That's how fast it's going. And here's the problem. There's not $8.6 trillion worth of folks in the United States who are willing to loan money to the United States government. There's only $3 or $4 trillion worth of incredible wealth in the United States that's willing to loan their money. You know, it's like George W. Bush was born with a multi-million dollar trust fund. A lot of that was in treasuries. Debt. So when we pay the $340 billion interest on the national debt every year, about $3,000 of your tax bill, $3,000 of the tax bill of every taxpaying American, when we pay that every year, that goes to pay the interest payments to the people who are holding the debt, to the Bush family, to the Saudi royal family, to the Chinese. The Chinese are holding about $1 trillion of our debt. So here's the problem. What happens if the European countries start raising their interest rates, that is, raise the amount of money that they will pay somebody if that person borrows money from them, that they'll pay for borrowed money, above ours. And the Chinese say, hey, you know, we can get a better rate of return on euros if we borrow euros, or if we loan money in euros, rather, if we buy euro-denominated bonds, treasury bonds and things, we can get a better rate of return in Europe than we can in America, so we're not going to buy your debt anymore. We're not going to finance your country anymore. America becomes toast. Then you have an economic disaster. So the only solution is to raise interest rates, but it's a two-edged sword. You raise interest rates to keep the Chinese buying our debt, but raising interest rates is going to throw the country into a recession. You can tell now why Alan Greenspan got out while the getting was good. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Welcome to George Bush National Park, where the air smells just like diesel. And there ain't no animals left around here except snakes, skunks, rats, and weasels.
Yes.
Now we ain't got no waterfalls or rivers. This fine man of stuff gives us the shivers. And we don't need Yellowstone or Carlsbad Cavern. 'Cause all the wildlife we need is in the tavern.
Well said. Well, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. What's happening with the dollar? Are the chickens coming home to roost? Is it going to be something bad and sudden, or is it going to be gradual and, I'm frankly inclined toward the assumption, toward the opinion that it's going to be gradual and yucky. What we're going to see is something very similar to the stagflation of the 1970s, when a somewhat similar policy that both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon followed by way of financing the Vietnam War, the chickens from that policy came home to roost, that being, you know, trying to borrow money and have, you know, social programs at home, the Great Society, for example, LBJ's program, and Nixon carrying on with that stuff. But in the meantime, there are some weaknesses now that didn't exist at the time of Richard Nixon and LBJ and Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. And when Jimmy Carter was president, we were not $8 trillion in debt. We were on the neighborhood of a little less than $1 trillion in debt, as I recall. We did not have a net trade deficit. We didn't have to borrow money from around the world in order to buy stuff from China. We were selling things to China when Jimmy Carter was president. We had a trade surplus with China. I was in China in 1986. I spent the month of November in Beijing. And at that time, we had a net trade surplus with China. I wrote a chapter about this in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, how, you know, I talked with a fellow there who was telling me that the Chinese saw the next century as the Chinese century. You know, they were getting ready, and I'm looking around Beijing, and there's, like, you know, this giant street with one car going by every 10 or 15 minutes, an ocean of black bicycles, and thinking, how are they going to do this? But that, you know, that was toward the end of the Reagan administration, and the drumbeat of free trade, free corporate trade, was really starting to whip up. Tom Friedman, I'm not sure when he published the Lexus and the Olive Tree, but it was the, you know, one of the major catalysts for Clinton's policy, NAFTA and GATT, all this sort of stuff. And now you stand on a street in China. I mean, you stand right where I was in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. I mean, I was there the year, either 1 or 2 years before the protests. Maybe it was even 3 years before. It was before, anyhow. And now you could stand on that street and you're coughing not from the haze of the little tiny coal-fired you know, people keeping one room in their house warm with a little brick of coal, and there were these stacks of coal that were stacked up in the alleyways and things. Now you're choking from the auto exhaust because it's traffic jams everywhere, and they're all brand new spiffy cars, and the city is filled with cranes. The biggest building projects in the world are going on right now in Shanghai and Beijing. Fastest growing economy in the world, India and China. And who's being hollowed out? We are. Because we're buying that stuff. Our church's chicken has outsourced their back office work, all of their accounting work, to India. Our auto manufacturers and steel manufacturers and toy manufacturers and clothing manufacturers and television manufacturers and stereo manufacturers, I mean, you name it, computer manufacturers, have outsourced everything to China. Why? Because we changed the rules of the game in the 80s and the 90s, and we changed the rules of the game to make it possible to do. And so, of course, businesses are going to do what's legal. They're going to do what's possible. If they can increase their profits on it, they're going to do it. When you have absolutely unrestrained capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism like this, where the ascendant power, and this is what the cons have been pushing for a long, long time, where the ascendant power in a government, in an institutional system, is not we the people. It's not democracy. It's not our elected representatives. It's not our voice being heard. It's the voice of capital. It's the voice of big multinational corporations. When you have, you know, 52 of the 100 largest economies in the world being multinational corporations, when you have Ronald Reagan no longer enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, but instead saying, sure, get as big as you want, as quick as you want, no problem. What do you end up with? You end up with a devastated middle class in the United States. You end up with an economy that is tottering on the edge. And, yeah, I just have to acknowledge, you know, where we're at right now and where we were at in October of 1929 are not that different. Although I still suspect that the rest of the world is not going to let us fall into a Great Depression. They saw that movie once before and didn't like it. But we are, you know, the steam is going to go out. And the question is, how do we prevent it from going out in a way that's really destructive? And there are answers to that, and most of them have to do with legislation. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Selling out is easy to do. It's not so hard to find a buyer for you. When money talks, you're under its spell. Ah, but what do you have when there's nothing left to sell? Selling out,
I'd rather call it compromise,
is easy to do.
Sometimes you have to close your eyes.
It's not so hard.
Being rich is no disgrace.
To find a buyer for you.
Put on your shoes and join
just
the race.
Ask any politician.
When money talks,
especially any Republican politician. Although, boy, it's getting spooky. David Sirota today writing about how Charlie Rangel, of all people, is now talking about preserving Bush's tax cuts for the rich. What? Charlie Rangel? Well, I guess anybody is vulnerable to the siren song of big money, which is why we need to reconsider the law that I was raving about at the very end of the show yesterday afternoon. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And just before I get to that, just very quickly, U.S. consumption spent on foreign goods. This is from the economyandcrisis.org is the website. 13,000, since 1980, since this all began with Ronald Reagan, 13,730 American companies have been sold to foreigners. That's $1,697,443,000,000 worth of our businesses. Which means that those businesses, as they continue operating in the United States, throw off profit, and that profit no longer stays here in the United States. Our sound recording industry is 97% foreign-owned. Our commodity contracts dealing companies, commodity contracts, 79% foreign-owned. Motion picture and sound recording industry, 75% foreign-owned. Metal ore mining, 65% foreign-owned. Motion picture and video industry, 64% foreign-owned. According to official figures, more than 8,000 companies have been sold to foreign corporations just in the last 10 years for at least $1.2 trillion. And that's just the official list. I mean, this is the selling off of America, the selling out of America, and the destruction of the American middle class. And it is all the conservative economic agenda to destroy America. And what do? They start talking about the war on Christmas. They start talking about, oh, gays want to get married. They start talking about, oh, there's no such thing as global war. Anything that they can do to change the subject from the real conservative agenda, which is ripping off the American middle class. Matt in Sacramento, California, listening on Talk City, KSAC. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Well, I was just looking into what Warren Buffett's been doing, you know, being a dollar bear, and he's been betting against the dollar and making hundreds of millions of dollars since the euro was selling for 91 cents, 86 cents.
Oh, yeah. If you had bought British pounds just 12 months ago, you would have made 10% right now.
Right.
I mean, 10% return in a year is pretty good.
So when people talk about the price of gold going up, it's really the dollar going down.
That's right. The price of gold is not going up in euros.
We're still buying gold at roughly, well, a little bit higher, but nothing like what we're doing. The country has to wake up.
Yeah.
The copper is not becoming more valuable. The dollar is really just dropping.
That's exactly right.
And so here's what I just did. I just bought some euros.
Mm-hmm.
And for $50,000, you get 36,000-something euros.
Mm-hmm.
Had I done this when Warren Buffett did it, it would have been about 55,000 euros.
That's right.
People have got to wake up. This $20,000 difference is in our currency, not a stock.
That's right. That's right. And
so we're literally, as you say, we're losing our country. And I talk to college kids a lot, and they catch on. They need a way out.
Yeah.
And they want to do something. So if you can think of any kind of legislation.
Well, the very simple thing is, number one, do away with all the trade agreements and go back to a tariff-based trade system where we decide what industries we want to protect in the United States. We openly call it protectionism. We don't overdo it. I mean, I'm not calling for Smoot-Hawley here, which, you know, pushed tariffs up into the 30, 40, 50% range. We can have tariffs at 10, 12, 15, 20%, depending on the how important is it to us to have, for example, a steel industry in the United States or a machine tool and die industry in the United States where we can make precision, things that we might need if we ever find ourselves in a world war.
We'll need.
You know, yeah, exactly. Well, God forbid, but, you know, there it is. So we look at the essential industries and we say, okay, we're going to put high tariffs on those so that those companies are going to stay here no matter what. And then we can debate what other, but let's have a public discussion about this. And I mean, this is how we did our trade policies for 200 years in this country, and it worked. It built one of the most powerful industrial nations in the world. And by the way, it's how Japan does it right now. It's how South Korea does it right now. It's how China does it right now. If General Motors wants to sell a car in China, they have to pay a 20% import tax to the Chinese. If China wants to sell a car into the United States, it's a 2% import tax, 2% tariff. What is wrong with this picture? So number one, that. Number two, let's get rid of the massive government debt that we have, which has nothing to do with the trade policy. This is just the plain old, we spent more money than we raised in taxes, by going back to a tax system that resembles that we had during the golden age of the American middle class, where we had from 1935 to 1964 a top marginal tax rate of 90%. And up until 1982, was it? Reagan dropped it, or 83? It was at 70%, somewhere between 70 and 90% top marginal rate. And number three, let's take the cap off Social Security so that the Social Security system is totally solvent, so that Bill Gates is paying the same percentage of his income and Warren Buffett is paying the same percentage of his income into Social Security that I'm paying, and roll Social Security and Medicare into one program and come up with a single-payer health care system so that our businesses don't have to bear the brunt of our health care system and they can be internationally competitive. Those three simple things, which are all considered radical except for the fact that every industrialized country in the world is doing it except us, those three simple things I think would solve 90% of our problems.
And, by the way, they should put a lockbox on anything like Social Security surpluses.
Yeah, absolutely. It should be accounted for.
You cannot spend that any more than you go and steal from your grandparents.
That's right. And they made fun of Al Gore.
Or your
for
little
that.
Kids.
Yeah, well, yeah, that, which is a better analogy because, actually, you know, you're what right now the Social Security
trust
funds.
Oh, yeah, you're breaking their little piggy banks. I really think people are changing. And, you know, I appreciate your show so much. And people should go to your website and read the original of what you were talking about, the amount of our businesses that have been sold. Just get
it's incredible.
It.
Yeah,
and just download it and show it to people.
Yeah, and in fact, the website economyincrisis.org does a
great
job of it.
Anyway,
Matt, gotta move along.
God bless.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thanks for the call, Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara.
Good morning. As you're saying, what's the future for the dollar? So many countries, including our supposed ally, Saudi Arabia, have lowered pegging their currency to the dollar and have gone to the euro.
That's right.
And why are the conservative myths, the more they're repeated, I guess it becomes truth, that, number one, the economy is doing great. If you're not wealthy, you're lazy. If you raise the minimum wage, you're going to close small businesses.
These are all total myths.
Complete.
And what's incredible is that there are still people not only who buy it. I mean, I get it. I understand why there's people who would buy these myths because, you know, a lot of people just don't understand economics. And a lot of people, frankly, don't want to understand economics. But what's tragic is that there's people still out there selling it who know better.
Tom, you know, the people that got the refis to use the equity on their homes,
mm-hmm.
and now the interest rates are rising, and it's the money that they spent. They are spending the money from their equity right now. When
right.
that money is spent, they will have no more line of credit to go to.
Right, I know. And that's the day of reckoning that's actually happening. We're starting to see a rise in foreclosures now.
People will say recession, but they won't say depression.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see. And thank you, Barbara. And hopefully neither one happens, but time will tell. It's time to get liquid if you can. Kevin in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, you know, I'm a 26-year-old guy. I have a 2-year-old daughter, and, I mean, I don't make a lot of money. I make enough to stay afloat and whatnot. But, I mean, what are people like me going to do? I mean, are we really looking at, like, a possible depression? Is this not 1926, but is this the 2006 of the next depression?
It's possible. It's not. I don't think it's probable. There are a lot of folks out there who think it's probable. I do think that what's probable is that we're going to have some very, very difficult times. We had a pretty severe recession in the early 1950s. We had one in the 1980s. We had one in the 1970s, actually. We've had some rough patches, you know, where unemployment goes up 2 or 3%, 4 or 5% in some cases, where inflation goes up, where it's, you know, where basically the middle class gets wrung out and the very wealthy get wealthier. And
one of the things that I noticed is like the math this time, the math doesn't make sense. I mean, we're really kind of screwed here. I mean,
yeah.
As soon as people lose faith in the American dollar, I mean, it's only down from there.
It could be, what I don't want people to do is panic. I still think that this is salvageable. It's just that it's going to be the only thing that's going to salvage it is
people
very
need to rise up and do something about it.
That's right.
I mean,
very rapid legislative action.
We
need to wake up our people, and the people need to wake up our legislators. We need to be saying to our legislators, we want you to start paying down the national debt, and we want to start changing our trade policies to bring our manufacturing jobs back to the United States and stop buying things from foreign countries to the point that we have to borrow $800 billion a year just for our purchases. It's crazy. And so, anyhow, spot on, Kevin. And you know, in terms of financial advice and whatnot, to the extent that you can, avoid debt. I mean, that's the big thing right now. Kevin, thanks for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back with your calls and more on that. By the way, at the top of the next hour, Jeffrey Feldman, Frame Shop is open, is going to be with us, and then we'll be getting back to, frankly, this is a discussion I'd like to continue, plus news out of Iraq and other things. And an Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, our third hour. We'll be right back.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. A flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze. One leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills.
turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore.
According to the Internal Revenue Service, foreign interests now own a majority of U.S. industries, including mining, publishing, movies, cement, mineral manufacturing, rubber and plastics, engine manufacturing, and just under a majority of U.S. of businesses in industries including pharmaceuticals, glass, coal, chemicals, industrial machinery, transportation equipment, and oil. Amazing. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Spoke to you last week regarding this Charlie Rangel thing, and you had, if you remember, you had told me what I was the way of him talking out of both sides of his mouth. And this is exactly what I was talking about because I saw it on C-SPAN.
Yeah.
And I thought the Democrats would get the hint when they were voted in that we were tired of the way things were going. And what I want to ask you is besides when you say stand up, we stood up in November and said we don't want any more of this.
Yeah.
What exactly can we do? This is just so frustrating.
Well, with regard to Charlie Rangel, he's a very, very safe seat. He was elected with something like 92% of the vote. You know, he's an old-time politician, and he really knows how to work the neighborhoods and like that. And so I think that the basic thing with regard to Rangel is to get the word out about him. And you know, nationally, which is what David Sirota is doing right now. You can go over to davidsirota.com and read his latest piece on Charlie Rangel. It's pretty startling. And Rangel, but see, Rangel is just one of many Democrats who are taking these kinds of positions, and the majority of Republicans, of course. And in my opinion, we need to be holding all of our elected representatives accountable for this. My member of Congress here, Darlene Hooley, she voted for the bankruptcy bill. I gave her hell for it on the air. And off the air as well. That's what we have to do, is we just have to keep telling our politicians, our elected officials, we would like you to stand up for our interests. And then at the same time, work for voter reform, reform issues that will give us clean elections. Here in Portland, for example, we have voter-owned elections for the city council. I'd like to see that for all the state offices. Arizona's playing with us. Maine is doing it very effectively. There's a lot that can be done with vote reform, too. But if we don't get involved, that's the bottom line. If we don't get involved, it's going to go nowhere. John, thanks for the call. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great.
I have a question here on gold, and then I'll just hang up and listen here. Yesterday, Ed Schultz was bringing up this discussion on gold, and then I found it interesting that today you're having this discussion on the value of our dollar and all that.
Yeah.
Over the summer, there was this gold craze, and everybody was talking about it. Then it stopped, and, I don't know what was really up with that. But a friend of mine once told me, and this is my question to you. He said that gold is like the canary in a coal mine, and that as the dollar either deflates or decreases in its value, the price of gold goes up. Is that true? And I'll just hang up on this.
Well, that's broadly true of all commodities, including gold. But in addition, the other thing is that gold is something that people flee to as stable wealth, and so when the world starts melting down, people flee to gold as well. I'm not in the business of making investment advice, I am of the opinion that probably investing in commodities right now is wiser than investing in equities. If I was investing money, I would be putting it in the stocks of companies that are in the business of commodities like gold and oil and whatnot, rather than in the stocks of companies that are, for example, manufacturing things in the United States, because they're all under assault. Look at what's happening with Ford. It's just an absolute disaster. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave.
There may be hope for the country with the newly elected congressmen and senators. But I think when we try to give advice to the administration that is the White House, I've come to the conclusion it is their intent to do harm. It is their intent to devastate the people. It sounds like a sick thing to think.
But no, I agree with you, and I don't think that they think of it in those terms. They think of it in terms of, let's ratchet down people's lifestyle a little bit so that they'll be a little less in our face and they'll be a little less aggressive. I mean, keep in mind, the high point of the American middle class was the 1970s. And what did you have? You had women demanding equal rights. You had African Americans demanding equal rights. You had people in the streets. You had students saying, hell no, we won't go. You had the middle class basically standing up and saying, we want part of this democracy too. And it scared a lot of conservative politicians. And they said, oh, wait a minute. We can't have this middle class. Chuck, and good point, Dave. Chuck in Hoover, Alabama. Hey, Chuck, just a half a minute before we've got to wrap up the show here.
Okay, hey, just real quick then. With the whole, like, taxing and doing the higher taxes on the wealthier, I just finished reading Neil Bortz's book about, like, getting rid of all income tax.
Right.
And going to, like, a flat, federal sales tax.
Right, and that way all the people who are in there living by sitting on their butt around the pool, like Bortz would like to do in his old age, waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, pay virtually no taxes at all, and all the rest of us, the middle class, pays all the taxes. I mean, that's
okay.
The bottom line. That's why right-wing cranks like Neil Bortz are promoting that.
Okay, because I thought, and some of it looked like it made sense.
Yeah, it's sort of, it sells well, just like the flat tax kind of sells well until you dig a little deeper and you discover that it's really the Walton family who are pushing this kind of stuff. So, Chuck, don't buy it. Trust me, don't buy it. There's another author. Oh, man. Go over to BuzzFlash.com. My BuzzFlash book of the month is on this topic. 57 minutes past there. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of the Tom Hartman radio program here. And Jeffrey Feldman is with us, the editor-in-chief at FrameShopIsOpen.com. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you with us. What do you see as the largest frame that's in operation right now?
Well, I think there's a real tug of war that's going on between the media and the White House over how to define what's going on in Iraq. It all started on Monday morning, when Matt Lauer, of all people, on the Today program, announced to the world that the NBC was going to change the label that it was using to describe Iraq. He said they were going to change to the phrase civil war. Hmm. It was this incredibly dramatic announcement. And it radically, it immediately caused a reaction from the White House later that day in the press conference with Steve Hadley, who's a national security advisor, and Tony Snow. They responded with the phrase sectarian violence, using that phrase about seven different times in 20 minutes. And ever since, there's been a real struggle over that phrase. The White House really does not want that phrase civil war to catch on in the media. They don't want the public using it. And so I think that those are the two big ideas that are out there right now.
So there's a framing war going on.
Absolutely, a framing war over civil war.
Yeah.
And if you listen to what the media is doing, it'd be really interesting for the public to track this, whether or not newscasters or politicians are using the word violence to describe what's on the ground in Iraq or using that phrase civil war.
Yeah.
Those are the two sides of it.
Yeah. My take on this is that the phrase civil war is going to win, that the press is going to win, that they've basically, there's been a debate inside the media for the last 5 or 6 years, ever since, right after the 2000 elections, there was a story in the media, AP, as I recall, carried it, about one of the senior vice presidents at CNN making a pilgrimage to the White House, to Washington, D.C., to apologize to George Bush for the way that they treated him in their pre-election coverage, occasionally, making fun of him and pointing out his faux pas and running audio of his mangled use of the English language, and assuring him that in the future they would do everything they could to clean up his language and his clips and things and portray him in a positive light on CNN. And it was one of those stories that just kind of lasted for a day and then vanished, because there was no, at the time, no left-wing press, as it were. There was no Air America. There was nobody out there to grab it. You know, no Center for American Progress or whatever. No frame shop is open to grab it and point out, you know, hey, look at this. And it just kind of went away. But I think that that was part of a herd mentality on the part of the press, that they were in the process of going along with what, you know, the Brent Bozells of the world had been pushing for some time, and what the Bush administration was essentially demanding, which was that the press will become an instrument of the institutions of power rather than an instrument of the people.
That's right. Either fall in line or be excluded. And from what I understand, what the White House did, they would monitor all interactions between the press and the White House, and if things did not go well, then whichever reporter it was would get a series of follow-up calls from the White House from people who would say, look, you know, you were supposed to treat us in this way, and it didn't happen. So there were real consequences to not towing that line.
Yeah, interesting. But I have a feeling that many people in the press are starting to say, it's like kind of waking up from a long trance, you know, that they're saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, what have we been doing?
This relationship's not going well. We need to change things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But Newsweek is also going to be, has been a big driving force behind this phrase, civil war, because Fareed Zakaria, who is a very respected journalist and expert on international affairs, he just published an article in which he talked about also a civil war, and using this very interesting image of our soldiers being caught in the middle of a civil war, he used this phrase that they're being shot at by both sides, which is a very poignant metaphor that I think breaks down what's going on in Iraq in very simple terms that the American public understands. Once you place the soldiers in the middle of that civil war, then the public begins to lose their patience and calls for the soldiers to be removed from that very difficult situation. So there's a lot at stake for the White House to scramble and to throw a lot of fog up in front of that, so that people are looking at violence, something which is a less clear cut, doesn't have clear sides, and so they'll just, you know, the public will fall in line and listen.
Well, and in fact, over at frameshopisopen.com, you, Jeffrey Feldman, you're blogging that this stuck in the middle or caught or trapped frame is one that the Democrats have, in a way, kind of gotten stuck in, and instead could use to their advantage.
Yeah, I think that it's a powerful way to talk about what needs to be done in Iraq. I mean, for a long time, the Democrats have been trapped in this idea of saying two things when it comes to Iraq, talking about supporting the troops, but then being against how the policy was carried out in Iraq. It's a very, very difficult idea to get out there. It's not been very persuasive. I think that what the Civil War frame allows for the Democrats to do is to stand up and really define the problems and the danger that our soldiers face. They're stuck in the middle of a very difficult situation. They're caught in President Bush's dangerous policy, and they really need to be released from this no-win situation that they're trapped in. And I think it's a very strong way for Democrats to push forward towards solutions rather than just accounting for what they did in the past.
Right, and that's the true way to support the troops.
Exactly, to get them out of that crossfire, which is really a no-win situation. And we have had this in some respects from people like John Murtha, who's used phrases such as, there's no military solution, there can only be a political solution. But again, that's not as clear as this idea of our soldiers being trapped, caught in the middle of two opposing forces.
And in fact, I would guess that probably the majority of Americans are not sufficiently politically sophisticated to understand what that means, to say that there has to be a political solution, not a military solution. They just, you know, they're stuck in this old dichotomy of you win a war or you lose a war.
Exactly. And beyond that, the idea of protecting Americans, protecting our soldiers from a situation that does not benefit us or them, is a very basic progressive worldview that resonates widely with the American public. What we're really talking about here is identifying a very dangerous situation that our soldiers are in, and to no benefit to anyone when they get shot at from both sides of this civil tension in Iraq. That doesn't really aid anybody. And so the American public responds very strongly when we start to talk about our soldiers being in danger and in need of being protected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. What I'm curious your take. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman. He's the editor-in-chief over frameshopisopen.com and one of the leading experts on framing here in the United States. And I'm curious, Jeffrey, what your take is on how the Democrats are going to frame their activities going forward. We have this 100-day frame that Nancy Pelosi has put out, which I thought was brilliant. It's certainly not original to her, but you know, it's and it plays well on this new book that's out about Roosevelt's first 100 days. But or actually it was 100 hours. It was the 100-hour frame and the 100-day, you know, thing historically, but she has to go beyond that.
She has to move beyond 100 hours. I think that what they're going to try to do is stack up a series of achievements. Leading up to the election, there was a lot of talk amongst Democrats within the frame of good and bad management. A lot of critiques came against the White House that they really were not good at governing well. And so what I think that is going to happen, particularly in the House, is that they're going to try to pass basic legislation that they feel can get passed and should be passed, like increasing the minimum wage, and they will try to stack up a series of accomplishments so that very quickly they can talk about what they have done already, instead of getting weighed down in critiques, getting weighed down in negative press. I think that the Democrats are actually quite concerned that if they start to critique the president, for example, through oversight hearings on Iraq, before they have a stack of legislative accomplishments, then they'll get broadsided by the press and by Republicans.
They have to build some political capital.
They have to build it up, and they have to show the American public that they're actually there to work again, rather than there just to cause trouble. It's been a while where you know the Democrats have been a very strong, you know, trying to be a voice of opposition, and now they have to show that they can get it done. And I think that's really what's at the core of this 100 hours idea, and it's what they're going to be pushing for.
If the Ellen Ratner, our White House correspondent, told me that she had lunch with a Republican recently, senior Republican, who told her that there was an economic, not necessarily a disaster, but an economic problem looming on the horizon, and the Republicans were going to do everything they could to postpone it until a few days after the Democrats took power in the House and Senate, and then drop it like a bomb on them. How should the Democrats prepare for that?
An economic disaster.
The housing market collapsing, the numbers, the unemployment numbers being recalibrated. I mean, there's a number of numbers that the White House could release that would immediately cause the stock market to drop 200 points, and that they've probably been jerry-rigging for the last 6 months.
That's an interesting question. I think that what is really a strength in the Democrats' pocket is talking about how the economy has thrived under Democratic leadership in the past, and about how much secrecy the Republicans have been involved in terms of manipulating things behind the scenes. So
we need to go back to the mantra of, you know, yeah, I'll take Bill Clinton's taxes if you give me Bill Clinton's economy.
Absolutely.
Or I'll take Jack Kennedy's taxes if you give me Jack Kennedy's economy. Or, you know, I'm not sure that LBJ is the phrase that we want to use, although, which is tragic. But yeah. Anyhow, Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, the website. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
It never makes no sense. Fire, fire, fire. Light up your lighter. Fire, fire, fire. Armageddon is a deadly day. Armageddon is a deadly way. They're coming for you every day. While senators on a holiday. The army recruiters in the parking lot. Hustling the kids, they're juggling pots. Listen, young man, listen to my plan. Gonna make you money, gonna make you a man. Bam, bam.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Oh, man. The economy in crisis. Where are we going to go from here? How are we going to get there? 13,730 companies, U.S. companies, with a total value of over $1.6 trillion have been sold to foreigners since Ronald Reagan started transforming America with the Reagan Revolution. 13,730 corporations, $1.69 trillion. Some major reasons why America is facing, frankly, a terrible, crisis? Vulnerability. Let's put it that way. Let's say that America is terribly vulnerable now, and I think that this is not unlike the global warming situation. We know about it. we can do something about it. It may not be too late to do something about it, but if we don't do anything about it, if we keep going down this road, whether it's the global warming crisis road or the economic crisis road, and frankly, I say that they're intertwined, then there is going to be a brick wall that we're going to hit at 60 miles an hour. Our trade deficit, $723 billion last year. What is this money being used for? It's funding foreign competitors with $1.4 million a minute. $2,400 per person, U.S., is going out of the United States in our trade deficit. Each one of us is buying $2,400 worth of stuff from overseas that is not being balanced by people overseas buying $2,400 worth of stuff from us. And so we're having to borrow that money, and then they say, okay, well, you know, we want something in exchange for that debt, so we'll take Chrysler. We'll take Zenith. We'll take Westinghouse. We'll take, you know, we'll take your companies, right? We'll just take your companies. It's pretty straightforward.
Born and bred in the USA gives me the right to say my say, and I've got a few opinions to disperse. About all the changes that I see, direct effect on you and me, some are for the better, some for worse.
This is the Blue Collar Guy song from the Economy in Crisis website.
Trade deficit has me upset with our ever-increasing debt, loss of our manufacturing base. Scores of American industries being sold out overseas and foreign companies taking our place.
And indeed they are, over and over, all over the place.
AT&T and RCA, they're born and bred in the USA. They've learned to parlez-vous français, that's real. And even IBM PCs passed on to the Red Chinese and 500 patents part of the deal.
Whoa.
And Westinghouse abilities with nuclear facilities recognized throughout the global span. And it's so hard to determine just how Chrysler became German and why Westinghouse sold out to Japan.
And indeed they did.
Yes, I'm born and bred in the USA, and what's gone wrong since my heyday and the nature of the problems that we face? America the supplier became America the buyer, losing our world preeminent place.
And see, this is the point. It's not just that all of a sudden Americans decided to start buying cheap stuff from overseas. What it is that Americans are always going to go for the lowest prices, generally. It's just kind of common sense. What had happened is that the rules got changed, that some very, very powerful people got to the people in power, and people like the billionaire Thomas Friedman, you know, writing his Olive Tree and Lexus and World is Flat, and they started peddling this mythology that, you know, all we need to do is just kind of get rid of all those barriers to trade so that the multinational corporations can do business in a way that's incredibly profitable for them.
When Zenith was the Zenith, a proud American name, it meant the tip of the top, the cream of the crop, the best name in the game. Quality, technology, American know-how slipped away from the USA and belongs to Korea now.
Yeah, Zenith is a
Korean
company.
We still live in a grand lifestyle beyond our means for quite a while, extending spending like there's no tomorrow. And the debt we are creating just keeps on accumulating, and to pay it off, we borrow, borrow, borrow. Once upon a time, we were self-contained. Our resources are being drained, spite of all you might read in the news. We must be self-sufficient, independent, and efficient, and once again produce all that we use. This is my call to action. Get America out of traction with renewed vigor and imagination. To be all that we can be, from sea to shining sea, a proud and solvent independent nation.
There you go. What a novel idea. Proud and solvent and independent nation. Gee, who could have thought? We only did it for 220 years. And then along came Ronald Reagan and Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton and Bush Jr., and 26 years of insane international trade policies and borrow and spend domestic policies. 27 minutes past the hour. do it, my friends. The place where being progressive never felt so good. Hang on tight to your dreams. Dreaming of a positive future for the United States. Dreaming of sanity returning to the halls of Washington, D.C., and our state capitals as well, and our local municipalities. Dreaming of a future where every American can be sufficiently secure that they don't have to worry that they're one paycheck away from homelessness, or that they're one illness away from total disaster, or that they're going to get wiped out in their old age and have nothing to pass on to their kids because they're not a billionaire, and therefore they're going to get hit with the death tax of having to be completely impoverished before they can have Medicaid pay for nursing home facilities and things like that. This is, it's just crazy that the United States is alone among industrialized nations in not having a reasonable social safety net, and instead having these wild, disparate differences in wealth between the working poor and the extremely, extremely rich, between the middle class and the extremely rich. To quote Warren Buffett, he said, you know, yes, there is a class war in America, and my class is winning. It's not a good thing for democracy. That's the thing about it. It's not a matter of, you know, envy or, you know, gee, it's a zero-sum game. It's about what's the best thing for democracy in the United States. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Bob in Westport, Washington. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I really agree with what you're saying. And the thing, I'm a Vietnam-era type of guy, and I came back from the Civil War over there. And when we came back, we basically had to pay for the war. I mean, there was a sign in Seattle saying, well, the last person leaving town turned the lights out.
Yeah.
Interest rates went up to 13-15%, and it took us years to get back on our feet as a country. And these guys, our Democratic senators, as well as all the Republicans, just keep on raising the debt limit. And I really hope Pelosi and the Democrats will finally say, look, no more just automatically raising the debt limit and getting us deeper in debt. We've got to start solving this problem.
They will only do it if they start hearing from us.
Well, we wouldn't
And you know the good news,
Bob, America.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, without Air America and the light you put on the topics, I think we would have they would have had the elections again, and we would have been sunk. So, you know, there's nobody like you, and there's no one like Air America on TV. There's no war coverage. You don't see any cop, and it's not America's war. It's sanitized. It's a mercenary war, and they got us in another civil war that they can't win. And it just, I feel really sorry for the troops over there. I'm an American. But I just think that we've got to get our congressmen and our senators to start facing up the truth, paying the debt, and realize where we're at. And we've got no allies in there. It's just such a sad, how did we do this again?
Well, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. The reason why we did it again, Bob, is really simple. It's very profitable for a small number of very wealthy and powerful companies. This is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about. The war industry has become one of the major industries in the United States. And in order to operate in a profitable fashion, it needs to have wars. And until enough of us stand up and speak out and say, no, number one, we're not going to have wars just so you can have profits. And number two, we're not going to let you borrow money from our children and our grandchildren, or for that matter, from our retirement, in order to have your wars. Thank you very much. We would like to have a country at peace, and we'd like to have a country with a reasonable standard of living. Now, the good news, Bob, is that I think that the majority of Americans, regardless of what they call themselves, including a lot of people who have, for the last 20, 30 years anyway, called themselves conservatives, on these issues, on these economic bread and butter basic issues, are by and large in alignment with our worldview on this stuff. And I don't see this as a left-right issue. I see this as a populist versus corporatist issue. And that transcends the boundaries of Republican and Democratic, and that transcends the boundaries of what's traditionally called left and right. And that I think, is the good news. So we'll see how it shakes out.
I agree with you. And as long as we don't have Tom DeLay and the hammer making people vote for DeLay instead of voting there for constituents, maybe we have a chance. But it's really going to take the senators to understand that they're Americans before they're Democrats or Republicans and solve our problems.
That's right. And senators and members of the House of Representatives as well. Well said, Bob.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
You know, Tom, I was just going through the cable channels, and I got the Bloomberg, I guess, International Economic News.
Right.
And if I'm correct, there's a company a hedge fund called Citadel with a C.
Yeah.
And the lady that was narrating the program said,
is this the one that melted down?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. The lady mentioned the company. I don't think it's melted down. But I think it was Citadel with a C, and because I seen it underneath. And she said that it's a hedge fund, and their profits were up fivefold in the Mideast this year.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, they'd almost have to be connected to Bush's and Cheney's war profiteering machine, wouldn't they?
Most likely, yeah. And it's most likely the same people. Although, you know, at a certain level, I mean, if you or I were the kind of folks who were sitting on tens or hundreds of millions of or billions of dollars, for that matter, and we saw that the country was going into a war, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that McDonnell Douglas' stock is probably going to go up. And you saw that Halliburton is going to be bidding on these things to know that Halliburton's stock is going to go up. So I think, you know, it's just at a certain level, it's probably just wise investors. The thing that concerns me about hedge funds is that most hedge funds are invested, many hedge funds are invested in a whole variety of things called derivatives that traditionally were used to hedge risk. In other words, you say your company is buying steel. Say you're General Motors and you're going to buy, you know, 1 million pounds of steel over the next month or whatever it is, you know. The price right now is selling at X, you know, $2 a pound, or I have no idea what steel sells for, but let's just say it's, you know, $2 a pound. And you want to buy that, and you can't lock in the price, but you're doing your budgeting against that. So what you do is you offer to buy it at whatever the market is as you need it, and then you make a contract with somebody on the side that you will sell to them at, $2 a pound or below or above. I forget which way it would work. But that contract on the side is that hedge, basically. That's your
it's the bet on the bet.
That's right. It's the bet against the risk. And
right.
you lose the bet entirely if you win. That is, if the price stays low. And on the other hand, if the price doesn't stay low, then the other guy is forced to sell to you at that price, and he loses the bet. And you know, it's a variation on puts and calls. And the mind-boggling thing is that last year there was like over $300 trillion. Of money that was basically in bets, that was, you know, in these different types of bets, you know, attempts to secure against risk, and they have become their own
worst enemy.
Well, they've become their own equity. They've become their own.
Right.
You know, people are trading in the bets, and rather than just making the bets to hedge their trading.
I know.
And this is something that has a lot of people in the world very concerned. Exactly.
I understand all this, but can I make a real point here?
Sure.
The point I'm trying to make is Bush and Cheney and their cronyism and their corruption. Basically, I thought this morning, you know, these people, they don't compete like 99% of us. You know, and unfair odds, you know, on a free market. It's not really a free market. It's a fixed market.
Right.
What they do, they compete when they take their payoffs and their campaign contributions. They run economics the way that Cheney hunts. It's all a setup.
Yeah, you're right.
They fix their competition. They put them out of business. They buy them out. And what they do is they take a 5 to 10 step process and they transfer the equity from a lesser person.
Right.
To,
you're absolutely right. What they're doing is they're transferring the equity from us, from the middle class, to them. And it's an old game, Armin, and it's been going on in this country for you know, well over a century. But you're absolutely spot on right. Jonathan in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling about the comments made by Newt Gingrich at the First Amendment Award Dinner. Have you heard about that?
Ironically enough, yeah, we talked about it yesterday on the program. He basically said that because of the war on terror, we might lose a city in the next decade. Apparently, he never heard of New Orleans. And because of the war on terror, we have to rethink free speech in America.
I find it kind of ironic that conservatives believe in a free market when it comes to economic policy, but not when it comes to thoughts or ideas.
That's a good point. That's a good point. There's a real irony there. Yeah, well said, Jonathan. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Yeah, appreciate it. Todd, Marina, California. Hey, Todd, we have about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Oh, hi. How you doing today? You know, you've been talking about the middle class, and, you know, health care, I believe, is one of the first things that we're losing.
Yes.
And a lot of your callers are really against socialized medicine and, you know, what a bad thing it is.
Actually, very few of my callers take that position. A few of my guests do. We get these right wingers on.
Yeah, you're correct. And, you know, I'm 33 years old. I'm a veteran. I've had HMO coverage. I've at times had to have Medi-Cal, and I currently have my veterans health care.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically socialized medicine.
It is.
And it is
socialized medicine. The government owns it, yeah.
And of the three, it is not a bad program. I mean, I've had a couple doctors who I haven't cared for their bedside manner.
Yeah.
But as far as the quality of service, you know, and the only drawback I can see is, you know, if you have to go into some mental health departments, you know, because of the Vietnam veterans and now the Iraqi veterans coming home, if you don't have a service-related disability regarding that,
it's a matter of eligibility. But Todd, you're making a very, very good point. And the fact of the matter is, we do in the United States have a socialized medicine program. As you point out, it's called the Veterans Administration. And we also have a single-payer health care system in the United States. That's called Medicare. And frankly, I think that we should either take the VA system and say for everybody, or my preference, Medicare for everybody. 45 minutes past the hour.
Cheney's got a gun. Dick Cheney shot someone. Cindy, she in better run. Better watch her liberal.
Victoria Jones, another White House correspondent. Dick Cheney has a gun, Victoria.
Oh, no.
I understand he actually shut down traffic on a Florida highway.
What?
You didn't see that story? It was, I have to track it down now, but it was Cheney went hunting, and they had to shut down traffic on a Florida highway because he was hunting down there. I'll dig it out. And,
unbelievable.
Yeah. It's but, you know, it was sort of like, you know, Clinton's haircut, only worse, because Clinton's haircut actually didn't stop traffic at LAX, even though the press all thought it did. But anyway.
It didn't stop traffic? Oh, I
no.
thought it did.
No, it did not. And in fact, most of the Los Angeles Times and Newsday and all, 2 weeks later, published apologies, public apologies and retractions. It was a story that was entirely invented by Drudge and the right-wing talk radio hosts.
Amazing.
Yeah, he actually did get a haircut on Air Force One. That's actually a very common thing. And but it didn't stop traffic at LAX at all. Nothing. Zero. So.
Well, I mean, speaking of Drudge and the right-wing media, it's interesting that Rush Limbaugh, I believe, today is speaking to an expert about the Iraq study group. And this expert will basically be discrediting the Iraq study group. So I think what we're seeing now is the setting up of the Iraq study group by the right wing to be, if not liberal, then at least irrelevant.
Well, let's see. Expert. X means past their prime, and spurt is a drip under pressure.
There you go.
Well, I had a guy like that on my local show this morning. One of these neocons who's going, "Wow, this whole thing is a," and really, there's some truth to it. You look at the Iraq study group and everybody on it, left and right, they're basically all political hacks, and none of them have any experience in the Middle East.
That's right. Nobody has any experience in the Middle East, and some seem to have no experience in anything. I don't know why Sandra Day O'Connor's on it.
Yeah, I hate to find myself agreeing with Rush Limbaugh, but or perhaps his guest, but this seems to me like it's all about, and in fact it was put together in the first place, all about finding ways for Junior to save face. And that Newsweek was probably right, that this was being orchestrated by Poppy.
But this is not, unfortunately for Junior, I think, going to enable him to save face, which is why he's had his own internal study groups doing in less than a month what the Iraq study group's taken many months to do. So I think that he can turn around when the Iraq study group comes out with its findings that he won't like and say, well, you know, we respect the findings of the Iraq study group, but our own research has shown,
right.
And then we'll hear how different his findings are.
Which raises the question, is it his findings or is it Cheney's findings?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that's a great unanswered.
Yeah. See, I don't think that Bush is sufficiently engaged, curious, sophisticated. I'm lacking the word. I mean, but I don't think that he's sufficiently participating in the process to really be a to really have a deep and serious understanding of what's going on in Iraq and therefore be able to make policy decisions. I really believe that these decisions are being made at the level of Dick Cheney. I mean, Saudi Arabia, for example, they said, we've got a problem over here. We need to talk to the guy in charge. Who do they get on the plane?
But they know this guy. I mean, you know,
they know Bush, too.
Yeah, they know Bush, too, and they know them, you know, because of the oil. And it is interesting that there's been very little follow-up on the story that was briefly mentioned in the Washington Post about how it was the Saudis who summoned Cheney and not Cheney who initiated this trip.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I mean, if the White House is going to refuse to talk about it, then it's hard for the newspapers or anybody to keep the meme or the story alive. You know, it's just a tough one. What else is happening in Washington, D.C. today?
The talks between Maliki and Bush have been put off until tomorrow.
So Maliki didn't show up today?
Well, I don't think it's so much he didn't show up, but the talks have been put off. Now, some people are extrapolating from that embarrassment about the leaked memo has caused Bush to put off the talks until tomorrow. We don't know the reason for the putting off the talks until tomorrow. We just know that they have been.
Now, we're talking the memo is the Stephen Hadley memo from his meeting with Maliki, basically saying the guy is nice, but he's a lightweight and he's in over his head.
Right, saying at best he's a nice lightweight, leaving room open for him being worse than that, yes.
Right, right.
And then the other piece of news is that Colin Powell, in a speech he gave in Dubai, has called it a civil war.
Interesting. Well, that doesn't surprise me. But the leaking of this Hadley memo, do you really believe that this was a leak, as in an unintentional leak? I mean, my sense of it is that this is something that the Bush administration wanted to be out there. That what they're trying to do is they're trying to take down Maliki. He's Shiite, and I think that the Bushies have decided that they need to throw in with the Sunnis. They need to have another Saddam Hussein, you know, another strongman Sunni dictator, and they're setting up the existing government to fall.
I don't know if that was what was going on, but it wouldn't put it past anybody to do that. That kind of thing has been done before.
Yeah, certainly, and not just in Iraq. I mean, you know, our support of Saddam Hussein, though, for years and years and years, good case in point. But it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, how this all plays out. And any word from Sadr? You know, I mean, Maliki actually went to Jordan, right?
Sadr's saying that he's pulling out of the government.
He's pulled the plug. He's blowing it up.
He is saying that he's pulling the plug. Yes.
Yeah. Then there's that's about a third of the government, isn't it?
But we don't know if he has pulled the plug. He's just saying that he will pull the plug.
Oh man, that's now you really can say you have a civil war. You don't. I mean, this is like the American Civil War. You've got separate governments for all practical purposes. What Sadr will do is he'll set up a government exile or an internal government. You know, a confederacy. Yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news. At the top of the hour, we're going to be talking with Joan Roughgarden about about evolution and Christianity, then Larry Scott with VA Watchdog, and then back with your phone calls and more news. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of By and For We, the people of the United States of America. You know, sometimes you think you know what you know, and sometimes you think you know what others know, and sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what you do know, and sometimes you don't even know what you don't know that you don't know, and sometimes...
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Is it possible that Jesus and Darwin have something in common? Joan Roughgarden has written a new book called Evolution and Christian Faith, Reflections of an Evolutionary Biologist. Joan, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
What do Jesus and Darwin have in common?
Well, they, of course, have the Bible in common, and in particular, what I was able
to... Darwin's in the Bible?
Darwin's, the antecedents of Darwin's theory of evolution is in the Bible. And so one of the exciting things when I was doing the book was realizing that the metaphors in evolutionary biology, which trace really probably to the dawn of agriculture, are also found in the Bible. So I was able to find passages in the Bible which you could almost lift verbatim and plug it into an evolutionary biology textbook.
For example?
Well, the two main ingredients of evolutionary theory, that's what explains the facts of evolution, are the notion of natural selection, and that's presented really in lots of places where husbandmen and shepherds are discussed.
The sheep were, or goats, wasn't it, with spots and without spots, the
right.
story, and
then,
what is it, Samuel or something like that?
Yeah, well, and no, so there's the farmer Jacob, but then there's this long passage where God himself does the selecting. And so in this passage in Jacob, about Jacob, the farmer, Jacob made a deal with Laban, his former master, about keeping, certain, sheep that were speckled and cattle that were brown. And Laban had been giving Jacob a hard time, and Jacob was a man of God, and to recompense Jacob for the injustices he had suffered, God caused his stock, that is Jacob's stock, to do most of the breeding, and therefore the stock of cattle and sheep became progressively under Jacob's ownership. So that's God guiding the hand of natural selection, the hand of God guiding natural selection and causing evolution to occur.
You know, now that I think back on it, I recall reading those passages, and you know, it never occurred to me at the time, hey, this is a description of natural selection. This is a description of you know, careful breeding. How do you know what happens when you sit down and talk with somebody who considers himself a biblical literalist and who claims that evolution is antithetical to the to Christianity? And you lay this information out. What kind of response do you get?
Well, I've been doing this now for several months. I mean, one issue is who gets to say who's a literalist, because I'm certainly not taking liberties with the text. And
so you're the literalist here.
Yeah, I mean, I might be. The question also could be asked: was Jesus a literalist? Because Jesus was willing to contradict certainly the teachings in Leviticus about diet.
Yeah.
And Jesus is quite clear about this, about teaching from principle, and that's why he taught in parables, rather than sticking to the letter of what had been, even at his time, scripture, which was maybe 2,000 years or 1,000 years old.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Joan Roughgarden. She is an evolutionary biologist. She has a new book out called Evolution and Christian Faith. Is it your hope that this book will transform the debate about intelligent design?
Well, somewhat. I mean, first of all, we've got to get people talking. And I'm grateful, I must say, to the intelligent designer folks in having provoked the discussion on this. As a science teacher, you know, we have a hard time trying to get people to talk about science. I've put a lot of people to sleep at cocktail parties by telling them about my research, I can assure you. And intelligent designers, you know, for all one says about them, you know, have got the general public talking about evolution and about science. And I think that's a good thing. Now, we need to make it a productive and constructive discussion. And my book, I think, for people who want to fight, my book is dissatisfying. For people who are looking for peace and for points of common, of commonness between science and tradition, faith traditions, then it's a great book. It's a, as you may have seen, I don't know if you have a copy there.
I do. But a lot of these folks just want to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, it doesn't matter what you say. This is where we're standing. And for that matter, you say, I mean, you made the point just a moment ago that the intelligent design folks are stirring up a lot of debate. But on the other hand, there are a lot of communities in the United States where they've shut down debate, where they've actually gotten textbooks edited in schools, where they've got entire bodies of information no longer being taught.
Oh, I don't think so. I think you're overestimating the impact they've had. And so far as I can tell, the intelligent design movement is nearly dead. I've been tracking the alerts on Google, for example, and it's really dropped off.
It's alive and well in the homeschooling movement, I can tell you that. You know.
Well, that could be. But remember, the problem we're facing is that 60% or so of the American public is skeptical about evolution and want, so to speak, both sides taught. Mm-hmm. And so that's a lot more than the homeschooling folks or the some of the extreme opponents of evolution, like the young earth creationists. And
right.
So we're talking really about a great many people who do want to know what it's about and are really quite open-minded or, in some sense, just sitting on the fence and uncommitted one way or the other. They want to hear more.
Yeah. It's a fascinating discussion. And this book, I found it fascinating. Joan Roughgarden, the book is Evolution and Christian Faith, Reflections of an Evolutionary Biologist. The website is evolutionandchristianfaith.org. Joan, thanks for being with us today.
You bet. Thanks so much for your interest.
Thank you. Good talking with you.
Right.
I appreciate you coming on the program. It's 13 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brad in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Brad, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for putting me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to see if you had caught this story that I saw on truthout.org about a war protester committing suicide by
Malachi Ritscher.
What's that?
Malachi Ritscher.
You got it.
R-I-T-S-C-H-E-R. Ritscher probably is how it's pronounced.
Yep.
Yeah, I have it right in front of me. The folks in the chat room have been talking about it. Blue has been talking about it. This is a 28-year-old, oh, I'm sorry, where'd it go?
He's 52-year-old.
Yeah, it was a 28-year-old being interviewed about him. 52-year-old experimental musician who had fought with depression all his life, and he poured gasoline over himself and set himself on fire in Chicago 4 days after the election, 4 days before the election to protest the war. And it didn't get reported. Nobody was listening. It took Cook County 5 days to figure out who he was and what had happened. And an alternative weekly, finally, Chicago Reader, put the thing together and spread the word. And, you know, the question, I think, it hasn't gotten much coverage, unlike the Buddhist monks, for example, who burned themselves to death, again,
right.
in the 60s in the protests against the war. I think in part because the American media doesn't talk about suicides. There's sort of an unwritten, maybe it's even written someplace, I don't know. I'm not a J school graduate, but there is this rule in journalism by and large that you don't talk about suicides because there is some evidence that when you do talk about suicides, it encourages other people to commit suicide.
Huh.
And so you don't want to do that, and you know, particularly it causes teenagers to commit suicide. Whenever there's a high-profile suicide in the news, teenage suicide rates go up, particularly locally.
Yeah.
And so, you know, generally reporters just don't like to talk about that kind of thing. And there's, you know, from reading the article on Truthout, it's pretty clear to me that there's a question about whether this guy was really protesting the war or whether he simply wanted to commit suicide in a way that he could rationalize.
Right.
And if it's the latter, then I would agree with the media in passing on the story.
Uh-huh.
If it's the former, then it's a story. And what made the Buddhist monks a story was that it wasn't just one person, you know, who was fighting with depression all his life. It was essentially the institution, institutionalized Buddhism, an entire sect of Buddhism in South Vietnam that was doing this. I mean, it was, you know, dozens of them. And as an anti-war statement, and I think that's somewhat different from this, but it does, you know, it does deserve to be noticed, and people can find it over truthout.org. So, thanks for the call, and thanks for bringing up the topic. I know our friend Blue in the chat room will be very happy about that. Good talking to you, Brad. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hey, the rules, you're gonna miss all the fun, Lord.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or, you know, how about single-payer health care? Or a VA system that works? That would be a nice plan. Larry Scott with us from VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Hey, Larry.
And I've appointed myself, Tom.
and a fine appointment it was. I second it.
And, you know, well, thank you. And the VA does stand out as a shining example for a nationalized health care program. It's a government-operated system that works. And I know you and I have talked about, we kind of have a different idea of how this might be implemented in years to come. But it is an example that a system that large, funded by the government, can work and can work efficiently and effectively.
Yeah, it is socialized medicine, and it does work.
And yes. Yes, yeah. And I don't mind using that term. You know, people will look at you and say, what does that mean? And no. And I say it's exactly what it means. It is socialized medicine. It is run by the government for the veterans. And it's a system that works, and it works beautifully, too.
Yeah, and in fact, I think that we need to use the phrase more. Because the contrast, there are basically three options. You can have private for-profit health care, which is what most of us have. You can have socialized medicine, which is what veterans have. Or you can have single-payer program, government program, which is Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, you know my bias that I prefer the single-payer one. I think it's probably, you know, a little better than socialized medicine, just because I've used the healthcare system in England, which is more socialized, and the healthcare system in Germany, which is more single-payer. And, you know, my sense of it is a single-payer system is better. But I wouldn't have any problem with socialized medicine in the United States.
Nope, I wouldn't either.
Yeah. So
I've seen it firsthand.
Yeah, so over at VAWatchdog.org, there was one story over there this morning that David pointed out to me. It just seemed to me like a shocker. I don't recall what it was, though. What in your mind, what are the top stories on VAWatchdog?
Well, the top stories here in the last week, really, is that the VA is developing a policy that would allow veterans to buy their prescriptions at Walmart and Target because it'll be cheaper. That's an interesting story.
Oh, this one, the one that got my attention was this whole the Santa Barbara chapter of Veterans for Peace revealed to be a Pentagon surveillance target.
Oh, yeah.
And was that on your website or did I?
No, actually, I didn't post that story.
Oh, okay.
Although I am very, very familiar with the story, and I've seen the interview with the national director of the Veterans for Peace.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no reason to be monitoring Veterans for Peace.
Yeah.
In the area where I live, Tom, and where you live in Portland, Oregon, there's a very active chapter, and a good friend of mine runs it, of Veterans for Peace. And they are exactly what they say. They are veterans. They have gone out and served their country. They've come back from war and said, no, that's not the right way. We want to be peaceful, and that's exactly what they are, but the government has been monitoring their activities, and it was rather interesting because the final report that was issued said that while these are peaceful people, there is the potential for violence in the future.
Yeah, right.
Right. Well, you know what that is. That's some bureaucrat covering his rear end. His boss said, we think these people might be a problem, and so you go out, you monitor them for 30 days, and you say, there's nothing going on here, but I can't write a report that says there's nothing going on because my boss wants me to find out that there is something going on. So what you say is, well, there's nothing going on now, but something might happen in the future. So you've covered your rear as a bureaucrat doing investigative work in the field, and you haven't offended your boss, and your boss can say, see, I told you so.
But you
and that's what it is. It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. This is what we saw in the 60s and the 70s all over again, Tom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you get to continue spying on the American people, on peaceful Americans.
Yeah.
Veterans are skeptical. Over at VAWatchdog.org, you're talking about how this wave is coming. I mean, people talk about the demographic wave of the boomers retiring and what it's going to do to Social Security. That's nothing compared to what the Iraq War veterans are going to do to the Veterans Administration.
Well, the wave is here. We're seeing the first part of this wave. Give it another 5, 10, 20 years, and the wave will overwhelm the system if something isn't done. We have veterans coming back now. And as VA Secretary Jim Nicholson just said a couple of days ago in the interview, they're not coming home in body bags. They're coming back on a gurney. And that presents a whole different set of problems to the VA. The VA must be funded properly. It is not at this point in time. And it all boils down to something that's really very simple, Tom. The VA health care budget is part of a discretionary budget. Congress argues about it every year and they say, okay, well, I guess we'll give you this amount of money. The Democrats for the last 6 years have tried to get in mandatory funding where each hospital would say, we have this need. That goes up the line, all the needs are added together, and then the money is automatically put in the budget. There are no questions asked. You will see that pushed in the 110th Congress on January 3rd, 2007, when the 110th is sworn in. That's going to be one of the first dramatic moves, I feel, for veterans coming
this
out of that
Congress. To make the VA budget non-discretionary?
That it will make the health care portion of the budget.
Okay,
the health care.
Now, is that something that's done by law, or is it done by administrative fiat? I mean, who actually makes that decision? Who makes that rule?
Okay, that is done by law. Congress votes on that. Right now,
so Congress decides what is and what isn't discretionary.
Congress decides what is discretionary and what isn't discretionary. Congress can pass a law. Can pass legislation that says the VA healthcare budget is no longer discretionary. It is now mandatory. Set up a series of formulae, and every year the money's automatically in there, and there are no questions. I look for that to happen after the first of the year.
Yeah, and let's, to the extent that we're having conversations with our elected officials, particularly members of the House and the Senate at the federal level, we need to be telling them that that's what we want. VA health benefit funding should not be discretionary.
That's exactly right, Tom.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
First we got the bomb, and that was good, because we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, because the balance of power is maintained that way. Who's next? France got the bomb, but don't you grieve, because they are on our side, I believe. China got the bomb, but have no fears, they can't wipe us out for at least 5 years. Who's next? Then Indonesia claimed that they were gonna get one any day. South Africa wants two, that's right. One for the black and one for the white. Who's next? Egypt's gonna get one too, just to use on you-know-who. So Israel's getting tense. Once when in self-defense, the Lord's our shepherd, says the
Psalm. Good old Tom Larritz. Been a while.
We better get a bomb.
Better get a bomb. It's been a while. Now Iran is talking about it. Oh, my. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour, or 25 before the hour, for those of you who are, what is it, half full or half empty? Is it? Welcome back. The federal government's no sex without marriage message is not just for kids anymore. Just in case this story slid by you, this actually came out a few weeks ago. The federal government, the Bush administration, has decided that they are going to give millions of dollars, perhaps tens of millions of dollars, to faith-based, nonprofit, Christian, largely, organizations aligned with the Bushies and the Republican Party to teach abstinence to 20 to 29-year-olds. Yep, 20 to 29-year-olds. Okay, David, they're looking at you. I guess you're next, right?
Too late.
Okay. what can you say? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Pete in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Pete, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I used to be a biology teacher, and I just wanted to share with you how I approach the subject of evolution.
Ah, apropos of our guest about 30 minutes ago. Sure. Go for it.
Well, what I did, I knew I had some people in there that were religions that were didn't accept evolution at all, and I didn't want to have problems. So I said, okay, this comes to the part of the class where we teach evolution, and I know some of you probably don't agree with the idea of it, but I said, I don't require that you agree with it. I just require you know what it is so you can talk about it intelligently. And then I mentioned that I don't believe that myself, that God intended to explain the methods by which he constructed the earth and the planets and the plants and the animals and man. The Bible wasn't intended to do all that. And what man's trying to do by creating a theory is to see how God did it all.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and I never had a problem.
That's a nice frame. It's a nice frame, yeah. I can see where that would work. Thank you, Pete, for sharing that with us.
You bet.
Good to hear from you. John in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, John, what's up? John? Hey, John.
Yeah, basically a process question
mm-hmm.
relative to your interview with Jeffrey Hellman of Frame Shop is Open.
Uh-huh. You're talking about the Civil War frame, the decision by General Electric to, or NBC to use the word Civil War?
Yeah, who made the decision within NBC and General Electric, which is the, you know, the ownership of NBC,
mm-hmm.
to call Iraq a civil war, and why did they do that?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure anybody in the media does, or it probably would have been publicized. I'm guessing, in fact, that the right-wingers would be going after the person if they knew who it was. It was announced on the NBC, you know, on the morning news, on whatever their morning news program is, or what is it, Today or Good Morning America or whatever. I don't watch them, so I don't. But and I think it was Matt Lauer who announced it, as my recollection.
Yeah, I don't either.
But
I don't think Matt Lauer made the decision. So,
no, I guarantee you he didn't make the decision.
Yeah, I'm throwing it out because
yeah.
you have a wide national audience. And
okay, and maybe somebody will call in. Who knows? And we'll
mm-hmm.
see. We'll see how it goes. Thank you, John,
right.
for tossing that
right.
out there. And you know, keep listening. We'll see if anybody has any information on it beyond what you and I have. John in Seattle, Washington. Hey, John.
Oh, hi, Tom. Glad to talk to you again.
Thank you for calling.
You're What's welcome. What I was calling about was a slight. Well, you'd mentioned Dick Cheney's trip to Saudi Arabia recently, and he was going there mostly because of the war, I think, and oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I wanted to disagree. I personally think it's got more to do with the conviction just recently of a man by the name of Al Turki, last name, Saudi, in Colorado for sex slavery. And it's a thing that caused great concern to the Saudi government. They put up $400,000 to bail him out,
mm-hmm.
pay for a lawyer, and then when he got convicted just recently, he got 20 years to life, and his wife got exported, or deported, I mean.
Right.
And then the Saudis were having high-level talks for one website with the American government, and the United States Department, Bush's State Department, sent the AG for Colorado along with an assistant over to Saudi Arabia to explain to the Saudi king why this happened in American law.
Mm-hmm.
He also had to explain to the Al Turki family and to Bandar Bush.
Right. Bandar.
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 Yeah.
Why it happened. And
did they actually have the guy in custody? He's going to serve his jail term, or did he jump bail?
And tried and convicted.
Yeah.
And as far as I know,
Did Nick Kristof just did us over the weekend, over the last couple of days, Nicholas Kristof did a, I believe, it might have been Bob, the other liberal columnist there, his last name is escaping me, it might have been him, but one of them did a column on sex slavery. Was this part of that? Do you know?
I didn't read those. I don't know for sure. It might be.
Yeah.
Rumors.
So you think that Cheney went over there because now the Saudis are, I mean, this is pretty notorious, and it's not just Saudi Arabia, by the way, it's most of the very, very wealthy Arab states. They're fairly notorious for importing cheap labor from countries in the Far East, from Thailand, from the Philippines, Malaysia, and the Mideast, in the Pakistan, Bangladesh area, and then basically not just using them as physical slaves, but as well as sex slaves, and
exactly.
and it's just kind of common operating practice in Saudi Arabia, and so this guy gets busted here, and you think that Cheney had to go answer for that? I mean, it seems that they would do that.
Yeah, I do, because they were doing high level talks, and they got. Like I say, they got the AG, the State Department, our State Department paid for the AG and an assistant to go over there and explain to, the future, current and future kings
sure.
of that area and the Al Turki family
And, you know, they're quite upset about it. And so I, you know, I'm fully expecting a pardon to come down the pike here within a year or two. But the guy got 27 years to life. So
yeah. Well, I think you can be guaranteed that Bush will pardon him on his way out the door a year and, you know, 2 years from now. Let's see. Yeah. It will be 782 days, 9 hours, 15 minutes, and 10 seconds from now.
Good to hear.
According to my Bush backwards clock.
This Alperky family, I think that's like a family name, but I'm not 100%
sure. Yeah, it is. And they're one of the wealthier and more powerful families in Saudi Arabia.
Well, one of the family members is currently tied up in the British arms scandal slush fund that's going on. It came out of the, I think the Guardian and the BBC was talking about it, an all Yami contract.
Right. Yeah. Now here's the larger issue, John. Let's say that you're right and I'm wrong. That you know, my guess is that Cheney went over there because the Saudis are concerned that the price of oil, they're concerned that the dollar is going to crash and that the Chinese might actually be setting it up for the dollar to crash. And either they're trying to protect their investments in dollars because they're sitting on some $600-800 billion. I mean, they're sitting on an enormous amount of U.S. denominated debt. Either they're trying to protect that investment or they're trying to figure out what to do if the dollar crashes and oil is still denominated in dollars. That's my theory. You know, there's another theory that it has to do with the war in Iraq, another theory that it has to do with the Saudis are going to pull a plug on oil. They're going to start flooding. I just saw this today on a couple of blogs, that there's a suggestion that what the Saudis are going to do in the next few weeks is they're going to flood the world market with oil in order to drive down oil prices over the short term so that the Iranians and the Iraqi insurgents will be denied a source of revenue. Iranians,
that sounds good.
Yeah, the Iranians' primary revenue comes from oil right now. And so if the Saudis flood the market and oil drops to $30 a barrel, Iran suddenly has half as much money as they had before. That seems to me like a stretch, but there's a lot of people peddling that theory. And that might make sense about why Cheney would go over, that they're giving him the heads up and saying, you know, hey, tell Halliburton to start shorting oil right now. You know, it's like, buy puts.
I don't see it either or. I see it more like, you know, Cheney's going over there, and this is, you know, the sex slave angle and getting Alperky out of life in jail is a bargaining chip that Cheney can use. And I, you know, they've got a long relationship with the Saudi royal family, so I think this is, you know, just one more thing in that milieu that you were just talking about.
Interesting. Well, you know, the bottom line in my mind is that if Dick Cheney is our vice president, and he is, arguably, then, you know, what he does at a certain level should be transparent. I mean, somebody more than just Dick Cheney should know about it, at least some oversight committee in Congress, and I don't see that happening. John, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. It's an interesting one. 45 minutes past the hour.
Too many secrets, too many lies, got no good reasons and no alibis. Why are we at war and why do they die? Tell us you're sorry and then say goodbye. We won't gloat or treat you bad. Give you hard times like we had. But we'll learn the truth. 'Cause voters turned the Congress. Voters made the Congress.
And indeed they did. They turned the Congress blue. The Republicans put a 4.5 million vote thumb on the scale, and we turned out 5.5 million votes. Welcome back to the program. 9 minutes before the hour, and time now to check out what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq and the civil war therein.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 10:30 GMT on Wednesday, this all from Reuters. Dateline Samara, six policemen were killed and four wounded when a car bomb exploded near a police station in that town. Militants briefly occupied the building. A daylight curfew was then imposed. In Mosul, a suicide car bomber targeting a police station killed one civilian and wounded 23 in that northern city. In Baghdad, one U.S. soldier was killed and one wounded on Tuesday when a roadside bomb exploded near their vehicle in Salahaddin province. In Diwania, police said they found the body of a schoolteacher with gunshot wounds. Gunmen had kidnapped him on Tuesday. In Baghdad, Iraqi soldiers killed three insurgents and arrested 28 during the past 24 hours in different parts of Iraq. Near Bakhaba, U.S. military said its forces killed eight insurgents and two women in an early morning ground assault supported by an airstrike on a village near that town. Iraqi police said a U.S. Iraqi force killed eight civilians. Police said the dead were a man and his three sons and a neighboring couple, their son and their daughter. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol killed two policemen and wounded seven people, including two policemen in Baghdad's El Nahida area. And in Baghdad, gunmen fired on the Shiite-run health ministry building in central Baghdad after two mortar rounds landed nearby. Deputy Health Minister Hakim El-Zamile said that no casualties were reported and the gunmen later withdrew. In addition, George Bush did not meet today with Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq. And this, in the category of incompetent establishment over at thinkprogress.org, today's widely anticipated meeting between George W. Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki was abruptly canceled. CNN suggests that it, quote, was put off to Thursday after a U.S. memo cast doubt on al-Maliki's ability to deal with the sectarian warfare in Iraq. Bush counselor Dan Bartlett put that speculation to rest with this clear explanation. This is what Bartlett said. The president is going to have a bilateral and dinner with the King of Jordan. Hey, Louise, want to have a bilateral? Okay, the president is going to have a bilateral and dinner with the King of Jordan. Since the King of Jordan and Prime Minister Maliki have a bilateral themselves earlier today, everybody believed that negated the purpose for the three of them to meet tonight together in a trilateral setting. So the plan, according to, since they had such a good, productive bilateral discussion, was just for the president to deal with bilateral issues and other issues with the king this evening in a dinner setting, and then the meeting set for tomorrow will still take place as scheduled. So a plucky member of the press corps said, hey, wait a minute. The king and the prime minister had a meeting, but the prime minister hasn't seen the president since he got here, and the president changed his schedule to come here for this meeting. So Bartlett says, well, the president requested the meeting. This was the president requesting the meeting with the prime minister. And the substantive meetings on Iraq, look, they were not going to be doing a full detailed discussion in a trilateral setting about Iraq and the future of Iraq and the strategy anyway. That just wouldn't be appropriate. So it was going to be more of a social meeting anyway. But the fact that they already had a good meeting together, they felt like it negated the purpose of doing so. And the president and Prime Minister Maliki will have a very robust and lengthy dialogue tomorrow morning. So George W. Bush flew all the way to Jordan to have a social meeting with Maliki, which Maliki decided not to attend. There's nothing more to it. That should put all the speculation to rest. Aren't you pleased, you know? Yeah. Sharon in Camino Island, Washington. Or is it Camano Island?
Hello, Camano Island.
Camano, thank you.
My hero. Everyone knows not to call me during your show. Anyway, you talk a lot about Americans buying cheap stuff from China, right. And I have a Tag Your It proposal for your listeners. I've been on a crusade for a long time not to buy anything from China, if I can help it.
Good luck.
And I make it a point to voice my reasons to the retailer and ask them to tell their headquarters why I'm not going to buy stuff there. And it's really kind of fun when sales clerks approach me and ask if they can help me. I always say, yes, help me find something made in America or at least a fair trade country. And sometimes I have to explain fair trade. Sometimes clerks scatter. But I usually get a conversation going with everyone around me. And I have found to a T, everyone always agrees when they hear about the issues.
Yeah.
One clerk at a J. Crew store a couple weeks ago waved a sweater from across the room and said, "This is from Australia. Is that fair trade?"
Is that close enough? They speak English.
Right. And, so, and all my friends have had their consciousness levels raised, and they're looking at labels, especially when they shop with me. And
that's
they reject
marvelous.
Anything from China. Actually, it makes shopping an adventure, and it's fun and fascinating.
There you go.
And it's It saves me lots of money.
Good on you, Sharon. And this is something that all of our listeners can do as they go into the holiday season. Sharon, we have to wrap up the show, but thank you for the call.
Christmas crap.
There you go. Enough of the Christmas stuff. Coming up on tomorrow's program, conservative Keith Thompson. I'm going to be asking him, what do you mean when you say Democrats hate Bush more than they love freedom? Yeah, he actually says that. And Elizabeth de la Vega, a U.S. prosecutor, she wants to prosecute Bush. And Jimmy Carter will be dropping by. And remember, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.